the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Well, I am very happy to be here tonight and to serve as your master of ceremonies. I am no professional speaker, believe me. I was a professional drunk. But I used to have to drink before I could even talk. And then I got to talking too much, and I was in trouble. But I love these Alamo banquets. It takes me back and the memory I committed this program in 1976. That was my first banquet. And I had an awful problem with crowds at that time. Everything just seemed to gang up around me, but with the help of the people in this fellowship, that I soon adjusted to that. And it seemed like the more I went through, the more I found myself asking my higher power that if he would ever give me the courage and what little wisdom that could be spared, that maybe sometime that I could stand up here and not worry about mingling with the crowd, but to face it and to show my appreciation for what he had done for me. My higher power was and is a loving God of my understanding. And it seems that every situation that comes up, I have to turn over. I have turned this over, believe me, for the last 2 weeks, and I am running scared, and I'm going to ask you to bear with me. But it seems that every time that I have turned anything over, the results have always been the same. So I figure that is the will of my loving God that I am up here tonight. That is his will for me today, just as I think it is his will for you to also be here. And with just thinking of that, I know tonight I will myself, and you probably will, that I will be able, when I do give my thanks and my gratitude, show my gratitude, that I will be able to say, thy will be done, not mine. So if you'll bear with me, we will continue to do what is our most honest, noteworthy thing, and to carry the message, we will proceed. It is customary at the Alamo banquet that we read how it works from the fifth chapter of the big book, and to read how it works for us tonight. I can present Woody P.
Good evening, I'm Woody Powell, and I'm an alcoholic. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil, until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Thank you.
I would now like to call your attention to the members of the 1986 Alno Board. You know, this board takes over in March of each year, and at each and every meeting every month, this Alno, regular Alno banquet is the topic of discussion. Now, I ask you to hold your applause until all the board has been introduced. And I will ask the board members, when they're introduced, if they would remain standing. The ladies' vice president is Mary M. Ladies' director at large, Barbara P. Men's vice president, Andy W. Men's director at large, Joe Z. Our secretary is Woody P. Our treasurer is Larry D. I think he is sitting with his own home group. And this is our 1986 Honor Board. Show them our appreciation for what they have done. We also have a couple of secretaries that work out at Central Service, and I think that we have Kathy. Are you here this evening? She is one of the secretaries there. We also have another fine lady that works out there that has been a big part of my surprise, Gigi. But she is out of town, and she is sadly missed this evening. And now it comes to the guy that really sets up this whole thing. You know, I've never seen a man work as hard as our executive secretary does is he has to lay this whole thing out as far as the tickets and when the board does make any decisions as far as contacting anybody out there. Lou, that is his job to set up this whole thing. I'd like to show our appreciation to Lou P., our executive secretary. Thank you all very much for your service work. And now it comes time for our main speaker of the evening. I tell you, as you all know, I've been on a spiritual high for the past 2 weeks, but we've met this man, and I have been sharing with this man ever since he has got off of the airplane here, and it has been just one complete high for me. He comes to us from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He is a professor of mathematics at St. Joseph's University. He is professor emeritus. Right now, I'm going to call on Fred Kay from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Fred.
Good evening, everyone. I am Fred Kohler. I am from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm also a Catholic priest, a Jesuit, a professor of mathematics, and I have several other character defects also. This is my third trip back to St. Louis this year. And I can't tell you what a pleasure it is, and of course an honor, to be invited to come here. Just in walking around in the hall a little bit, several of the people who made retreats, the men and the ladies with me in January and in July, said such nice things. And it makes the speaker feel great when someone has a personal observation like that to make. It really is very nice. And I have enjoyed my stay here thoroughly. Now, when you're fortunate, as I am, to be invited to be a speaker to a group of alcoholics or Al-Anon people, at least in the East, there are certain things that we must do before we get into our message. The way we put it is, the speaker has to qualify himself. I have to make it known to my audience that I am not here because of the various titles that I hold. I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. That's the important thing. And I know the meaning of lying and deceit and all those great things that we did for years when we were drinking heavily. Now, I'm not going to go through a long drunkalogue for you, because all of us who have some years on us and drank heavily have our own. But I do want to go through what I like to call a sickalogue. Really? I don't really know how I'm here. With your permission, and briefly, I want to tell you what happened to me. First of all, I should mention to you that I am German on both sides of the family, completely. And the reason I mention that to you is this: I can never remember my first drink of alcohol. My grandfather had a big mug, my father had a little mug, and I had a mug about that big, and that was dinner. That was just an ordinary way that one had dinner at home. And I really was quite surprised when I joined the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to find that there were people who never had any alcohol, say, until they were 21. That was a new bit of information for me. Now, I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, and my early days were quite normal, high school, college, and that sort of thing. And I always drank. I always drank excessively. I look back on it. But never alcoholically when I was young. And the way I judge that is, I was always happy to tell people how much I had drank. It was great. You couldn't wait to get back from wherever you were and tell the rest of the college fellows how much you drank. Now, that's sophomoric drinking. It's nutty drinking, but it's not alcoholic drinking. When we started drinking heavily, the last thing we would do is tell even the doctor how much we drank, if we knew how much we drank. Now, my life went on in a normal fashion until about 1967, and I would say that's when I realized that I was a very sick man. I should have realized it before, but I was anesthetized with alcohol. My grandmother passed away. That wonderful old lady lived in Baltimore, and she and I were very close. And she passed away in 1967, and I went from St. Joe's University down to 30th Street Station to get a train to go down to Baltimore. I remember this very distinctly. And in those days, before the electronic era, those of you who have a little age upon you, remember that the porter used to stand at a blackboard, and he would write train 5 minutes late, train 10 minutes late, drop dead, or something like that on there. I was right up in the front of a large group of people who were there, and I was not able to read what he was writing. Now, it wasn't because I had been drinking that day that I could not read what he was writing. At that time of my life, my alcoholism had become so bad that I couldn't get started without that much bourbon in a water tumbler. My engine simply wouldn't start. That was the way I began my day. My problem was that I was losing my vision. Now, being an alcoholic, that didn't disturb me too much. Is that insane? You bet it's insane. So I got on the train and went to Baltimore. Fortunately, I went to the home of some very close friends of mine, a fellow I grew up with and his wife. They saw to it that I went to the funeral, but I did not get into any of the religious services. They did not permit me to make a fool of myself, for which I am eternally grateful. And after the services were over, they took me to St. Agnes Hospital, which is just outside of Baltimore, and I was there for 4 months. I went completely blind, that I remember. My kidney stopped operating. There was a wonderful doctor who is since dead. I had never seen him before, who really saved my life with a devoted effort. Wonderful old man. He told me that in the course of a long coma, I had had a heart attack, which I never knew. And when it was time to leave, after 4 months, his name was Alasia, a marvelous, dedicated medical man. And he said to me, "Now, Freddie, when you leave here, don't drink any alcohol because your liver and your kidneys won't stand it." Now, all I had to do was look in the mirror. I understood what he said, and I intended to follow what he said. So back I went to St. Joseph's University. That was in July. And in the end of September, I started teaching a very modified schedule. Long around the end of October, as I recall, I received a letter from the American Mathematical Society that the national meeting was to be at the Riviera Hotel in Las Vegas. And they were looking for mathematicians to contribute a paper. Well, my health had come back pretty well, and an alcoholic seeing an invitation to the Riviera Hotel in Las Vegas, you say, that's great. Absolutely. So I had an idea for a little paper, and I sent it in to the Mathematical Society. Great, come on out. Glad I go in January to the Riviera, present myself. And I remember giving my paper to my learned colleagues in the room on the side, and when I was finished, then I went to the casino. And I called over one of the pretty girls there, and I asked her to bring me a glass of Jack Daniels. which he did, and which I drank, and which I enjoyed. Now, at this point, it's imperative for me to tell you so that you understand what sort of a cat is talking to you up here. I did not have a slip. Now, that's strange, I know. I never had the slightest intention of quitting drinking. That never occurred to me. What I heard Dr. Alasia say was, "Freddie, don't drink any alcohol until your liver and kidneys are better." That's what the alcoholic hears. And that's important to realize, because then you will begin to understand that not only is alcoholism physical, emotional, and spiritual, but alcoholism, my friends, is an attitude also. And that attitude surrounds the alcoholic, just as a shell surrounds a little turtle. And when a threat comes to that little turtle, and the threat being anyone who would get between the alcohol and his bottle, or wherever I say his, please say her, between the alcoholic and the thing they want most in this world, that shell protects the little turtle. They don't hear that. They go right in there and hide. And that's the reason why when we go on 12-step calls, as many of you do, I know some of you very well, and I certainly do, we cannot permit ourselves to be discouraged, because the alcoholic, if he has no intention of getting better, is like the little turtle that goes in there and hide, and he's safe. And he won't come out of that, and he won't hear what you're saying until you leave. And when that door closes, then the little turtle will come sneaking out, and he's safe. It is also an attitude. So I went from bad to worse very quickly, and in March they sent me into one of the large Catholic hospitals in St. Joseph's, and I was a regular visitor there by that time, of course. All alcoholics that drink the way I did for a length of time, you almost have a private room with your name on it in a hospital. Now, they sent me in there, it was late in the afternoon in a cold March day. I was there that night and through the next day with tubes all over my body. And that night, they took me out of there under severe restraints, and I don't have the slightest idea what I was doing. I don't want to know what I was doing. And they took me out to a psychiatric institute, which in those days, believe me, was the pits. And I was there for 8 days, and I don't have the slightest recollection of being there. Nothing. The only one who ever came to see me that spoke to me in later times about it was a Jesuit priest who was also an alcoholic, and he passed away. And he said, "Freddie, when I came to see you," he said, "I went out and, if you will pardon me, threw up on the lawn." He said, "I thought you would never be released." So in a week, maybe 9 days, I was brought back to St. Joseph's University. And my religious superior is a very fine man in those days. And he came to me. Now, if you have been in severe restraints for a week, you don't do much eating or drinking. I could hardly hold my head up. And he said to me, "Freddie, do you think you might have a little trouble with alcohol?" True. He said, "There's a wonderful place named Guest House out in Lake Orion, which is just outside of Detroit, and it's for Catholic priests and brothers. Would you go out there?" And at that time, believe me, I was willing to go anywhere. So out I went to Guest House, and again, 4 months at Guest House. And it is a wonderful place. Everybody on the staff is an alcoholic. Everybody has qualified. And they treat you wonderfully with the finest kind of care that you could have. Well, in about a month and a half, my thinking cleared up enough to be somewhat rational at any rate. And I listened to the counselors. I like to listen to people. And the counselors there were men who had been maybe in other rehabilitation places throughout the United States. So they had been in smaller places. And I listened to them, and they were good. Now, I like to read. I've always liked to read. It's no problem for me. I'd rather read than do many other things. And so I read, really, just about everything that they had in the library on alcoholism. As I said, we went to three meetings a week, outside meetings, besides what we had in guest house. So heaven knows, if you multiply that by 4 months, you come down to lots of AA meetings. And I think it's reasonable to say that I learned 99.9% of what they were talking about. There's just one little bit that I didn't learn. I didn't hear them say, "Fred, you can't drink alcohol because you're an alcoholic." Now, by my nature, I'm not the macho type. I like to play bridge. I like to hit a golf ball. Oh, watch the pretty girls. Any sort of nice thing that comes along. So I didn't get into a lot of arguments. That's what a point I'm trying to make now. So they had no reason to keep me there. But every one of the counselors knew I had no intention of getting better. This was just a stopover. I knew I had no intention of getting better. I didn't know when I was going to drink again, but I had no intention. I couldn't conceive, my friend, of life without alcohol. It never entered into me. The shell was so strong around that little turtle. And so they released me. Back I come to St. Joe's. Went back to lecturing again in, I guess, the end of September, a modified course, modified schedule. And again, along around November or so, I received an invitation from the University of Pittsburgh, the Cathedral of Learning. Any of you people familiar with Pittsburgh? It's a beautiful, beautiful big building. And a large university. Would I be a visiting professor there? And that's what I needed, some place to change my roots where I could carry on the way an alcoholic wants to carry on. My office, again, I'm going to use a title which some of you will remember. My office, appropriately enough, was in a converted old hotel building which was called the Shenley Hotel. That's just where I belonged. Well, when you have a group of men from all over the world, and ladies, one alcoholic can spot the other one around a corner, as you know, and you have nobody looking after you, and you do something that's half-wild and half-wit intelligent periodically, and everything's fine. The rest of your time is drinking and carousing. And that's the way I spent the year. Back I came to St. Joe's, and things just got worse and worse and worse. And by 1973, I guess about the only way I can express my condition is that I was leaking oil. My ankle was broken in a ridiculous accident. I fell out of a rocking chair. True. And I was so full of booze that I don't think the little cells were even communicating with each other. The miserable thing wouldn't heal. So I had a new religious superior at that time, and he came to me and said, "Fred, we think you might need some help." Fortunately, there was a second guest house at this time, fortunately. The first guest house would have nothing to do with me. And I don't blame them either. So I went out to the second guest house. And for the first time in my life, I had a feeling that upset me terribly. Now, I could handle being an alcoholic. That really didn't throw me off stride. I didn't care. I didn't care about anything. But I knew that the men that were in the first guest house with me had gotten better. I knew that this whole group of fine men from all over the United States and parts of Canada who were patients at the second guest house were getting better. All I had to do was look down at my poor ankle, which wouldn't heal, and I had to drag it behind me. And for the first time in my life, I realized I was a loser. and that I could not handle. And when I tell you about these things, I would like to tell you how I felt, how a losing alcoholic really feels, so that you understand the depth of the pain and despair. And I look at myself, I said, now look, you have been counseled by the finest counselors available, good people. You have read all the literature in AA, or most of it. By the period of 5 years, if you were counting, you've been to 500 AA meetings, and nothing has helped you one bit. Nothing. The only thing that I could think to do was this. When I didn't have any obligation to attend out there, I took myself and my poor ankle and the 12 and 12 into the chapel because I couldn't go anywhere else. I had no option. And I read that 12 and 12 with the index finger of this hand just like a little six-year-old boy. And I read it one word at a time. And when I came to a comma, I said comma. And when I came to a period, I said period, and I stopped and I put it down. And I knew that the poor rundown at the heels people in Akron, Ohio, wrote this book for idiots like me, because that's the way they drank. And if it helped them, it would help me as long as, my friends, as long as I did not attempt to correct anything. For the first time in my life, I was willing to listen totally and absolutely, because I knew that left to my own devices, I'm a loser. Then I got closer to the third step. Now, I had read this before, and maybe 10 days went by in that process I just described to you, that total desolation. And as I got near the first three words of the third step, the first time in my life, I became truly frightened. Not of a heart attack, not of being blind, not of dying, none of that stuff. The horrible first three words, the things that murder an alcoholic, a drinking alcoholic, the thing that we cannot do, and that is made a decision. And sheerly out of desperation, I can remember all by myself in this chapel, standing up, pouring sweat, and I read that step out loud. Now, as best I can recall, that was July the 18th, 1973, and from that moment to this moment, my friend, never once, in any way, under any condition, have I ever had the urge to drink? Not once. Now remember, I did not ask the higher power to help me not drink. I didn't have the nerve for any of that stuff, you see. The one thing I did was exactly what those poor people suggested. And from that day to this day, I have been free of the urge to drink totally. The rest of my life is a strange situation, as I get on to what I want to speak to you about tonight. It's a very, very odd, strange situation. Just for example, I've given retreats all over the United States, 90 retreats to alcoholic people, the only kind I deal with. And I absolutely love it. And I'm the kid that couldn't even imagine being sober, not drinking. I remember when I was invited to come here, thinking, what would I like to say to you people? What would I like to say to you? And it's sort of fun when you have 6 months to think of what you would like to say to a people, because many of your faces came right to me, and we've had rather serious conversations together in the course of the retreat. And I would picture some of you. And I remembered that the man who wrote Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll, was a mathematician. And in Alice in Wonderland, although it is a child's story, are some profound mathematical ideas which only a mathematician would grasp. And then I said to myself, now look, Freddie, you're a mathematician of some regard, at least you were when you were younger. Why not write about your adventure in sobriety? My adventure in sobriety. And that's what I call my little talk to you, and I will not be all that long. But I would like to tell you about this fairy tale that is my life today. Just standing in front of you is a supreme part of it. When I left Guest House in 1973, I didn't have the slightest idea what would happen to me. And I really didn't care. I had no resolves. I was going to do better, do worse, nothing. Zero. I said, we will see what we will see. Now, I was blessed with a wonderful sponsor. His name was Matty Kay. He was a great fellow. He was an old, tough old Irishman. I used to call him the tough kid from 2 Street. And he had a face that if there was more room on Mount Rushmore, his face would have looked perfect up there in that stone. The tough kid from the 2 Street. And Matty gave me some advice on this journey. Matty was my guide. I guess that's what I should say. I had a magnificent guide. And the old gentleman said some great things to me. He said, Freddie, on our journey, you are prepared, you are permitted to look behind you, as long as you can look behind you without guilt. But he said, never look ahead. And many other wise things. He said, as you go along the journey, as we go along the journey, he said, there are many interesting places to stop and rest. And they are called meetings. And every major city will have a place where all you have to do is pick up the phone and you'll find a resting spot. You'll find a place to help you get your act together and forget your worries and troubles and the things that bother an alcoholic. And you see, I listen now to the things that old Matty said to me. Just this past summer, in early August, I was up in Bar Harbor, Maine, which is a great spot. I know some of you have been there. Any place where you can get a nice lobster dinner of about a pound and a quarter for $6.95 is an excellent lobster, excellent place to visit. Bar Harbor. Now, when I got there, I called the local alcoholic center. They gave me 2 meetings. I was only going to be there 3 nights. I went to 1 meeting. If you leave Bar Harbor, you're automatically in the woods. Maine is full of woods. And so, in about 2 miles, I came to the place they designated. There were maybe 70 alcoholics visiting there. And they received me wonderfully, like a long-lost brother. There was a lady there all the way up from Georgia. And she and I got to be great friends. They received her and myself just fine. It was an excellent meeting, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. Manny said to me this also. He said, Fred, if you find yourself getting hungry or angry or lonely or tired, if you find yourself overburdened with a little bit more than you can carry, he said, stop. And you take 12 steps in any direction. And those 12 steps carefully taken will put you right back on the track where you belong. Took me time to understand what the old man was saying, you see. But I finally did understand. 12 steps in any direction. And then he said, I'm going to tell you a secret. Every alcoholic has a marvelous little gift, which perhaps all human beings have. But this little gift is special to alcoholics.
He said, this is called a comfort level. When you were drinking, you didn't know you had it because you kept it anesthetized. But he said, now, if you will listen to your comfort level, it will get you, it will protect you from all sorts of trouble. Your comfort level will tell you what persons, places, and things to cling to, and what persons, places, and things to avoid. And he was right. You see, the comfort level, many people confuse with a conscience. That's not what I am talking about. That is totally wrong. The conscience is an intellectual operation which busies itself with good and bad, with right and wrong. The little comfort level, our great gift does not concern itself with those ideas. It's very simple. It simply tells you you are uncomfortable in a situation and get away. This person makes you uncomfortable, then avoid them. You are now uncomfortable where you are, go to a meeting. It's dealing with feelings. And those of you who drank know with me that the reason an alcoholic drinks is he thinks it will make him feel better now than the way he feels. That's why an alcoholic drinks. It's not a thought process. That's all baloney. It will make him feel better than the way he feels now. And the comfort level is designed to overcome that fearsome urge, force, drive that an addicted alcoholic has. The little gizmo, the comfort level. And if you gentlemen will permit me to talk just a little bit to the ladies, there's a little event that I want to relate. Now, you will understand what I'm saying, but particularly will the ladies understand this. I'm talking now about the comfort level and how it works. A few years ago, a lady whom I did not know, I had seen her at meetings, but I didn't know this gal. I'm going to give her a name. Let's call her Ellen. Now, she came to me with a problem that would sorely affect a recovering alcoholic woman. And it was this. Ellen had been divorced. Her oldest girl was maybe 21, 22, in that age. The husband had remarried. He was a very strong figure in Philadelphia. Money was no problem. He had remarried, and the girl was going to get married, the oldest daughter. She was invited to the reception. The question, Ellen, that tormented Ellen was, how could she go to that reception where the new wife would be there and booze all over the place, these were hard-drinking people, and maintain her sobriety? Now, do you see, that's a real problem to the lady for all those reasons I gave you, a real problem. So we talked, and I said to her something like this. If you went to this reception now, Ellen, suppose you had a table of your own with maybe five of your alcoholic friends with you, a support group. Would that help you? She said, oh, yes. She said, that would be great. Okay. She said, could I buy that type a bottle that looks like wine but really isn't wine and put it on the table so we won't stand out like a sore thumb? And I said, Alan, will this help you and your girlfriend? She said, I'm sure it will. Do it. She said, what am I going to do if the new wife comes over to talk to me? And I said, well, if you can stand up and talk to the lady, do so. Briefly, politely. You have your support group right beside you. I said, if you can't handle that and you're too uncomfortable, be sure you take one of the ladies with you and go to the ladies' room. I'm dealing only on her ease, her comfort. And if the whole bloody thing gets too much for you, take a girlfriend or two and go out and walk around the block. And let me know how you make out. In about 2 weeks, she came over to St. Joe's again. Smile on her from here to here. How did things go? Just great, Father Fred. As soon as I got uncomfortable, I acted on it. I didn't think. I didn't ask questions. I didn't wonder, may I do this? I simply did it because I knew what I was doing would make me comfortable. And what I was doing, my friends, is introducing her to the little gizmo called the comfort level, which is so important to us alcoholics. Now, I want to tell you one more little story on this same point, which affects me and which helped me ever so much. The fellow and his wife in Baltimore who took me to the hospital when I was going blind are very close friends of mine, very close. We've known each other since we're real little. We're fist-fighting friends. We go to the Preakness together every year for the past 30 years. Now, he has retired. He's made a lot of money. He's a great fellow. He and his wife are friends of mine. Now, their idea of going out to dinner is like this. They go out to dinner frequently. They will get a reservation at a nice restaurant, a fine restaurant, for let us say 7:30. And then we go out to dinner and we are there at 7:30. And we are seated at a table. And then the drinks start. And when I was drinking, I loved it. But then around 8:30, if anybody still wants to eat, you finally get around to eating, you see. And that was just dandy with me when I was drinking. Now, when I came back from the second guest house, I went down to Baltimore, and out we go to dinner, and the whole routine starts. Okay. I don't know when I have spent a more uncomfortable 1 hour than being locked in at a table with two heavy drinkers. You can only listen to the same story 3 times. That's the maximum. Most of us, at any rate. And I'm not very patient. But I did last through that without... I owe these people so much. And finally, we ordered dinner, and then we went back to their house. I have a key to their house. Beautiful situation. But I said this to them. I said, now, all these years, we have been friends, and we have had a great time. And I said words to the effect, I would like it to continue that way. You are my friend, and I use that word very, very carefully. I have maybe 3 friends, and I'm very lucky. Maybe 4 friends. I'm very, very lucky. But I said, if we go out to dinner again, I'm never going to go under your rules. If you invite me to go out, we're going to go under my rules, or I won't go. And here are my rules. If you want to have dinner at 8:30 and you go out at your table at 7:30, I said, I'll arrive at 8:30. That's fine. You can drink yourself silly. I don't give a damn how much you drink. But don't corner me there. I can't get up and walk around. I can't even go kick the dog when I'm cornered at the table. I said, on the other hand, if we want to have dinner at 8:30, why don't you start drinking here at 7:30? Suit yourself, I don't care. But being cornered at a table with 2 drinking people for an hour and you can't get up and do anything, I said, it makes me too uncomfortable. My friends saw exactly what I was talking about. They're nice people, fine people. We're the same friends we've always been, but they're the rules under which we go out to dinner, and it works fine. And the only thing I was hollering about was a little gizmo, the comfort level. You see, when we were drinking and we were uncomfortable, that little comfort level would glow red and the siren would go off, but we just anesthetized it. We put it to sleep, we killed it. Now that we're sober, it is a great, great thing to have. Also, in the journey through sobriety, it's very wise to make friends with your fellow travelers. It is an extremely wise thing to do. You'll meet some who have been on the journey much longer than you. You'll meet some very wise people who understand you and your problems. And they will share with you if you give them the chance. They are your fellow journeymen on this path. And they can help you in many ways. You can learn from these people. You can learn the tremendous gift of gratitude, which you will always find in an old-timer who is worth his or her salt in AA. I remember when I first came in and I heard people walking around saying the attitude of gratitude. I could have killed them because I didn't understand what they were saying. Now I know that the first sign of real quality sobriety is a manifestation of gratitude. When you see that, when you turn yourself inside out to get someone to go to a rehabilitation place, and finally they come back and say, "Thanks, Freddie. Thanks. By God, it makes your day." Just that one word. It makes your month. And some people never get that. You say they quit drinking. They're dry. But they never learn that quality of gratitude. And gratitude is not a natural virtue. It's not. How many times have you heard a mother say to a little 8-year-old kid who's just learning to write, "Johnny, if you don't sit down and write a little note to your grandmother for that beautiful sweater, I'm going to hit you in the head with a bookend." It has to be learned. It has to be exercised. That beautiful, beautiful virtue has to be practiced. The quality of gratitude. And I am so grateful for the higher power removing my obsession to drink. I want to tell you a story that I love to tell. It's simply my alcoholic foolishness. This is not a horror story. Just the absolute insanity of alcoholism. Now, when I'm lecturing in mathematics at St. Joseph's University, I still wear what you call a black cassock. It's a long gown that goes from your neck all the way down. I'm the only Jesuit who does. I also wear a white shirt with French cuffs. And I did a favor for the president of a large eastern racetrack some years ago while I was still drinking. And he had made for me a set of gold cufflinks with diamonds around the outside and a horse's head on them. And believe me, when I get all dressed up to go in and lecture, I like to say I look like one of Napoleon's generals. Or Mrs. Astor's pet horse. I don't know which way to put it. Now, I love to tell this because I don't want to forget it. It's just sheer alcoholic foolishness. I used to lecture to the senior... I'm not going to snow you, but I do want to tell you the silliness. I used to lecture to the brightest people in the university, the senior mathematics majors. There'd be maybe 15 or 20 of them in a large physics amphitheater. And the topic in which I liked very much was called the theory of functions of a complex variable. Now, I'm not snowing you, not trying to. And I had to, at one point, develop what are known as the Cauchy-Riemann partial differential equation. Those things, if you are completely sober, will take you at least 30 minutes. Now, in the big lecture hall, there were blackboards that went up and down. These were the old-time blackboards. And actually, you had maybe 3 or 4 blackboards to deal with without erasing. You could write, lift it up, write, lift it up, bring it back, refer to it, go and on. It was excellent, an excellent place. I should tell you as I go on, don't forget I used to start my day drinking with that much bourbon inside of me before I did anything. Also, those of you who have some years on you will remember the little Bayer aspirin bottles. They had a little brown top on it. Okay. Always in my pocket was a little Bayer aspirin bottle with a little brown top filled with bourbon. Always. That was my safety blanket in my pocket when I'm all dressed up this way. I remember going into the physics app. I must have been at the well twice this day before I got across the street. I remember going into the physics amphitheater with these brilliant young people there, and I start in trying to derive these involved equations, formally dressed the way I described. It was hot. And I remember breaking out into a perspiration. After 15 minutes or so, I didn't have the faintest idea where I was. These blackboards were going up and down like a... It was something for an Abbott and Costello comedy, believe me. And there I am trying to get the miserable equations derived. And finally, after about 40 minutes, I looked, and there were the blooming equations. Somehow or other, I got them derived. And I was so astounded at my own brilliance. This is the truth. I was absolutely so pleased with myself that I took out my little Bayer aspirin bottle and I took off the top and I drank it. Put the top on, bowed to the students, and walked out. Unbelievable. I have two comments to make. The first comment is, I'm talking gratitude, I'm not wandering, and I'm so grateful for my higher power for the great gift of sobriety. And the second comment is, the president of the racetrack that had those cufflinks made for me put the wrong end of the horse on them. One more point now. The importance of listening to your fellow travelers on your journey in sobriety. And they will tell you that one of the most important things to maintain your sobriety is to go to meetings. An expression that you hear around is that meeting makers make it. I was giving a retreat up, when I say giving a retreat, I mean to alcoholic people. The only ones I deal with, as I said. I love to be with them. I'm totally comfortable, as you can see. And I was giving a retreat up there. There were about 70 men on this retreat. And we were having dinner in the dining room the first evening of the retreat. And we were eating away and talking quietly. And the door opened up, and three healthy-looking young fellows came in, and they're bringing in a tall, slender old fellow who looked as if he didn't even know his own name, but he was wearing a most beautiful grin you ever saw in your life. And they bring him in, they sit him down, and we're all looking at him. They got some food on his plate, cut it all up for him, they're nudging him, now you eat, eat. So he begins eating a little bit, and he still has this beautiful grin. So the retreat progressed, and I would see him in the hallway or see him in the conference room when I was giving a talk. And finally, he came in to see me. And in the course of these retreats, I enjoy talking to the alcoholics so much. I enjoy talking to the losers as much, if not more, than the winners, because I learn so much from them. So I'll give him a name. Let's call him Henry. Well, Henry came in to see me, and he said something like this. He said, Father Fred, I'm having trouble. And I said something like, Henry, I know you're having trouble. I saw you come in and three young men were dragging you in there, put you in a chair and cut up your food. I know you're having trouble. So would you like to tell me about what the problem is? And he said, yeah. He said, I had a terrible slip. Well, tell me about it, I said. But I do want to make this point clear before you start, Henry. I know you've been sober for a long time. And I also know you had a terrible slip. I could see it with these three young men supporting you coming in. Now, I don't want any of your jive. What happened? We've both been in the program too long. Tell me the truth. I know you had an alcoholic attitude of a drunk before you had your slip. What happened to you? Oh, he gets this big grin again. You couldn't get mad at this old gentleman if you tried. And this is what he told me. He said, Father Fred, he said, I've worked hard all my life. I have a wonderful wife, three grown children, and they've moved out of the house. He worked for the company, and he named it for 30 years. And he said, 3 years ago, I turned 70, and the company let me go. I said, well, this shouldn't surprise you. This is the way most companies operate. And he said, yeah. He said, but I just stayed home in the house. And he said, you know, the only ones there were my wife and myself. And he said, the house was getting too small. He said, all I did was look at my wife, and all she did was look at me. And I wished I could think of an excuse to get out, and she would think of a million excuses to have me leave. So he said this one day, a few days ago, she asked me to go to the store. And she asked me to bring her back a loaf of bread, a pound of butter, a bottle of milk, and a bottle of vanilla. And he said, that's what I did. I went out in the car, I went to the store, I got a loaf of bread, a pound of butter, a bottle of milk, and a bottle of vanilla. And I put those on the seat of the car, and I started coming home. And I came to a red light, and the brown bag tipped over, and the bottle of vanilla fell on the floor. And he said, I picked up the bottle of vanilla, and I opened the top, and I smelled it. He's waiting for a red light now. He said, it smells so good, I thought I'd take a swallow. So he said, I took a swallow of the vanilla. I got thinking about that, and I went back and put my car in the garage, and I opened a bottle of vanilla, and I took a big swallow of that thing. He said, now I couldn't take it in the house. What would my wife say? So I went in, I put the bag on the table, and I left the vanilla in the car. So I hurried up and went upstairs. I heard her hollering, Henry, you brought back the pound of butter, the loaf of bread, and the bottle of milk. Now you go right back to that store and get me a bottle of vanilla. Henry said, yes, dear, I will. And he said, I went back to the store and I bought 12 bottles of vanilla. He said, 2 days later, those three young men you saw carry me in here came around and put me in a detox. And when the retreat was starting, they came around to the detox and dragged me up here, and here I am. I said, now, Henry, don't forget the question I asked you. Don't give me any jive. I knew you had a drunken attitude before you took your first drink. What was wrong? And he had that beautiful big grin on his face. He said, Fred, when I was fired from my job, age 70, I was hurt very badly. And for the past 3 years, I have never gone to an AA meeting. He said, that's why I drank the vanilla. I tell you this because I love to tell the story. But the point, I haven't wandered one iota. The point is, meeting makers make it. And I'm sure old Henry, if he's still alive, is in fine, fine shape now. He's a very good man. Now, I don't want to go on any longer. I have spoken to you at length. But I do want to tell you about my own gratitude and how lucky I am. And this little episode deals with the tough kid from 2 Street, my sponsor, old Matty Kay. Matty used to say to me when I was drinking after I had been to guest house and all that sort of thing, he'd come in, a damn bed would be shaking all around. He'd say, Freddie, I can carry the message, but I can't carry the alcoholic. I didn't understand what he was saying, and I didn't listen to him. Toward the end of his life, Matty developed throat cancer. He was in his mid-80s now. And it killed him. But his death was very slow, and the cancer was a hideous situation. So that his tongue was all swollen. And gradually, this cancer went up to his brain so that the wonderful old guy would lose a sense of reality. And we have an infirmary at St. Joe's University for old people. And there's one or two nurses on duty at night. There might be 14 or 15 very old Jesuits in there. They're waiting for the end. It's very nice, really. And there's a long hallway, and it's sort of dark. And these ladies would be nurses on duty 12, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. And it can be a little scary. And old Matt would get out of bed, and he'd try to get his robe on, and he would go up this dim hall. And he had lost contact, as I say, with reality and control of himself. And these nurses would get very frightened. He was still physically strong. And they would call me. Now, it could be 2 in the morning. Would I come down and get Father K back into his room? I'm the only one they would call. And I would get up. I'd have a couple of lectures the next morning. I'd go down and find Maddie sitting in a chair. And I'd sit down beside Maddie, and I'm two-thirds asleep, and I would manufacture something to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, AA. And as soon as I did that, as soon as he heard me saying that, the old man's eyes would light up, and I could see the sign of life in there. They would glow very keenly. And he would listen very intently. Now, he couldn't talk. He couldn't communicate. But by his actions, his hands, I could tell that he was vibrant again. And I might just be making up lies. What can you do at 2:30 in the morning when you're half asleep? But the old man would wake right up. Then I would say to him, now, look, grandfather, I'm very tired. I used to call him the grandfather. Look, grandfather, I'm real tired. Let you and I go back to your room now. And I want to sit in that easy chair you have and take a little nap, and then we'll talk some more. The two of us would go down a dimly lit hallway, and the nurse would be peeking, and she'd see us go by. Get him in his room, take his robe off. Come on now, get your butt up in that bed. Up we would get, cover him up, and go sit in the chair. And really, within 2 minutes, I could see he was comfortable. He was at ease, because I was there, and now he wasn't thinking of whatever was torturing him, but thinking of AA, and he drifted off to sleep. Now, that went on, frequently in the course of the last 2 months of his life. And I had the great honor of speaking at his funeral. Now, Manny was not an articulate man. He could never do what I have the pleasure of doing. It was simply impossible for anything like that. If he went to a step meeting, the old man had trouble even saying something at the meeting. He was so unsure of himself. But he would work at it. He had tapes on the steps, and if the step was to be the fourth step, Maddie would listen to the tape, memorize a couple of sentences, and say that. But he had tremendous respect by all the alcoholics in the whole Delaware Valley. Because when he finished whatever little thing he had memorized to say, he would always say the same thing, my friend. He would say, when you get up in the morning, if you will make the third step, in the course of the day, if you will practice the 11th step, if before you go to sleep at night, you will thank your higher power for the great gift of sobriety, if you will do those three things and go to meetings, you will remain sober for the rest of your life. And Manny did those. He died a hideous death, cold sober. I know many people in the Delaware Valley who do exactly what Manny suggested, and they're cold sober. I do it, and I'm sober. I know many of you do the same thing on your own, and you're sober. And I gently suggest to those of you who do not follow that easy practice, try it. And with the help of the higher power, you will remain cold sober for the rest of your lives. And by God, I thank you.
Thank you very much, Father Fred, for that very gratifying talk. We will now have the benediction by Bart W.
Thank you, God, our everlasting friend, for not only filling us with delicious food, but for nourishing us with the insights of our speaker, Father Fred. May we take the experience of this evening into our day-to-day lives and continue to grow in the daily process of recovery. Help us to be open and honest with ourselves and each other, and let us always be aware that you are forever ready to help us and that you grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change. You grant us the courage to change the things we can, and you grant us the wisdom to know the difference. With your help, dear Lord, we can learn to be ourselves truthfully, accept ourselves gratefully, forgive ourselves completely, and to love ourselves unconditionally. Help us to remember that when we let go and let God, there is nothing in the world too complex, too confusing, too powerful, or too overwhelming for the power of God to illumine, to unravel, and to overcome. Help us to remind ourselves that God is in charge, because when we let go and let God, all sense of pressure or stress disappears. We wait in quiet confidence and patient expectancy for God's will to be revealed. And when we truly let go and let God, we can be at peace. May God bless each and everyone here present and your loved ones. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Now, Father Fred's talk has been taped tonight. My Dick Craig Martin, Dear Kobe Tapes Incorporated. They will be set up right outside this last door here, and the tapes cost $4. Now, after we close, there will be dancing and fellowship, but there will be some of the tables that will have to be cleared out here so that there will be room for dancing. Now, some of the people will be leaving and will not stay for the dancing, so if you stay and one of your tables happens to be one that is moved, you will just have to fill in with one of the some of the other tables. I guess that is all, and we will close by joining hands, and we will close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespass, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Thank you. The music tonight will be furnished by Gary Brown. He's a DJ, and he'll be setting up pretty soon.